Boktips live med Knut Gørvel. Dagens gjest Jan Philip Senker.
Jan Philip Senker hadde et enormt gjennombrudd med kunsten å høre hjerteslag. Her, bare her i Norge solgte den over 150 000 eksemplarer, og den andre boken i det vi pleier å kalle Burma-trilogien solgte over 75 000. Han har nå gitt ut 6 bøker her i Norge. Og på første rad her i kveld så sitter Anne-Marie Støverud, som jo var den som fikk fart på denne boka, fordi det som munn-til-munn-bok. Og bare i den bokhandelen hun jobbet på Ark på Gardermoen, med hennes anbefalinger som det viktigste, så solgte de over 10 000 eksemplarer. Jan Philip Senker har vært journalist og korrespondent for Stern i Asia. Han har hørt om at jeg har vært på turné blant annet med Lucinda Riley, så for 2,5 år siden så ble vi enige om at vi skulle dra på Norges turné, men så kom koronaen. Så han har vært desperat etter å komme tilbake, og nå han her. Så please welcome to the stage, Jan Philip Senker.
Hello. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you for showing up here.
And now I have to talk English. As I always say when I do this, I have to apologize because of my bad English. I always say, I feel like the famous playwright Jon Fosse, who once said, my Norwegian is bad, but my English is worse. So, but I have written down some questions, so maybe it will work. Jan-Philip, your Burma trilogy, as I mentioned in the all the Norwegian you did understand, has been a fantastic success all around the world. But how did you managed to be a writer, novel writer?
Oh, that was my childhood dream, actually. I remember my mom is a mom, she keeps everything I write. And she showed me an essay I had to write in school, I think I was 13 or 14. And it was about what we would like to do when we are grown-ups. And I guess my classmates wrote soccer player, ballerina, dentist, police officer, whatever. And I indeed wrote novelist, which is unusual for a 13 or 14-year-old. And I had this dream, and I graduated from school, and then my parents asked me whether I wanted to take over the family business. They knew I'm not a businessman, but I wanted to study. And I said, no, you know what I would like to do? I would like to write books. And they looked at each other, and my father looked at me and said, books? But about what? And I think it dawned on me that at the age of 19, I was maybe a little too young. I knew what I wanted to write about, what I write about now, love and life. And but as I said, 19, I thought maybe I should suffer my first love before I write about it and should live a little. And then I took a detour and I became a journalist. And I did something, luckily, my kids don't do to me. I don't have an education. When I have to fill out forms, you know, profession, writer, education, I said uneducated, basically, because I only graduated from school. And then I worked as a journalist, I became a correspondent. And then I was like 37 and I had a wonderful life traveling the world, making good money. But I thought, you know, whether I was in Tokyo or in Jakarta or in New York, this is a detour. What I really want to do is write novels. But I was getting older, we were having 2 kids and, you know, making good money, and I thought, no, I have to try it. And then I took 3 sabbatical years from Stern and had all my savings and I wrote my first novel, The Art of Hearing Heartbeats. And I had no clue how to write a novel. I just wrote a novel I wanted to read and my wife wanted to read. And that's
and then you can think that's the rest is history, but but it was no success in the beginning.
No, not at all. I had really high expectations. I thought they would sell 60,000 hardcover copies in the first 2 weeks. Yes. And they sold 6,000 in the first 2 years. But this is a book which is made actually by you, by its readers, because people started to read it, they talked about it, and in those days they weren't blogging or there was no TikTok or whatever, TikTok. It was just word of mouth. People talked to their friends about it, to the bookseller, and when it came out as a paperback, it increased every month. And it's still a bestseller in Germany and in many countries, even though it's not a new book anymore.
Yeah, but you got it translated to English yourself?
No, I had this vision because I wrote the book in America. I had lived in America for 8 years, that I wanted the book to be translated into English. And I remember I went to the foreign rights lady at Random House, my German publisher, and said, "Miss Beitling, I would like this book to be translated into English." She looked at me and said, "Yes, Mr. Senka, many authors would like that." And she didn't even want to pay money for a sample translation. So I found the translator. I paid for the translator myself. I flew to New York to find an agent. I was rejected all over. I handed it at reception desks at publishing houses. Nobody ever got back to me. And after 10 years of struggle, 10 years of people laughing at me, you know, "How is America doing, Jan-Philipp?" "Oh, yeah, it's going to..." my last hope was a small publisher in New York, Other Press, and I handed her to her. And then 2 weeks later, I got an email regarding The Art of Hearing Heartbeats. And I knew this is the last rejection. After that, I would give up. And she said she read it in one night. She loves it. She will do it. And it's a small house. And usually she said to me, "I sell 1,000 copies, sometimes 2,000. Your book has a broad appeal. Maybe we will sell 5,000. I didn't care. The money she paid was less than I paid the translator. It was not about money. I just wanted this book out in the world. And I was just happy. We flew to New York, my family, everyone. And there was a book launch. And she said 5,000. And by now, I think she has sold more than 600,000 copies. Yeah. and that's nice. So that is, it's a story that tells you never, ever give up.
Yeah.
No matter what people tell you, no matter how the chances
yourself
are, if you believe in it.
Yourself is a fairy tale in a way.
Yeah, don't give up.
And you heard I mentioned Anna Maria here at the front. She is the one who started mouth to mouth in Norway.
At
in the
airport?
Gardermoen Arc.
Yeah, are here. How nice to meet you. We met before.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm so grateful to you.
Yeah, you owe her much money. We can take that. But the story in these three novels takes place in Burma. And
yeah.
It seems like you have a special relationship to the people there.
Yeah.
Can you tell us about it?
Yeah, Burma in the 90s was almost like North Korea, just with better weather. It was basically closed. You couldn't go there. You couldn't get a visa. It was completely isolated. And then it slowly opened up at the beginning of the 90s. And I was a correspondent. I wanted to do a story about this closed country. And I flew there from Bangkok. It's just 1 hour flying time. And I was completely overwhelmed. I had been to 70 other different countries, and I had never been to a place so strange. The airport was very small. There were no cars on the streets. There were no shops. People were all wearing long jeans. The men were walking hand in hand. People were, you know, kids were playing on the streets. And there was a very run-down car I hired at the airport. And I was so puzzled because I had just been in Bangkok. You know, and this is just an hour of flying time. And I traveled back 80 years in time. And I drove into town with my driver. And eventually I asked him, "Sorry, but is there a McDonald's in town?" I just wanted to check, you know, how far the West had approached. "McDonald's," he said. "Is the guy maybe Scottish?" He didn't know. And I spent 2.5 weeks there. I realized how, you know, desperate the country, how poor the people are. But they were, you know, living their life with such dignity, and I never ever heard a Burmese complaining about the situation or anything. I mean, it really did strike me, and I fell in love with them, the culture and the way they treated me, so friendly, so hospitable. And I came back year after year, sometimes twice a year, doing little stories for Stern. And then when I sat down to write The Other Frame Heartbeats, I knew this story, the way I wanted to tell it, Burma was the perfect place for it. And I started writing.
And I heard that one of your friends said maybe in an earlier life that you had been a Burmesian yourself.
Yeah, that's what they assume.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're so modesty and... Is it that?
Probably because I'm so modest and humble. No, I just fit in. I wouldn't say I fit in there, because very often there are things I don't understand. I mean, I have to be honest. Sometimes they're Buddhist thinking. I remember I once interviewed people who were really mistreated by the military, three guys, like Tata in my second novel. They were mistreated and tortured. And they told me their story. And eventually I said, oh, you must hate the military. And they said, oh, no, that was our fault. We deserve it. I said, what? Yeah, it was our karma. I said, are you crazy? I mean, you were tortured and mistreated, and now you say it's your fault, not the soldier's fault? Yeah, no, it was their karma. So sometimes I hit a wall understanding a different culture, but I think that's part of the journey. I'm not Burmese, obviously, and I think I deal with it in my novels that Julia, the main Western character, sometimes she hits a wall. She doesn't understand the culture, and she realizes how different she is. And that's what I sometimes did there. I realized how different I am. I just tried not to judge, just accept, try to understand where this is coming from, but don't judge. Just try to understand. And that's how I write my books, I think.
Some of that in your last novel, which we will talk about later. But as I said, we in Norwegian readers love your books. And how do you feel about Norway? What is your relationship?
I mean, first
I'm fishing here.
No, I have to tell you, I told you we had the dinner last night. Coming back to Oslo and meeting all of you, it's really, you're a great team, and it's almost meeting family coming home.
Thank you. I appreciate that
very much. And I have this special relationship with Norway, because the first time I came here, I was 15 years old. My parents had separated, and my mom wanted to console, I think, my sister and me, and she wanted to go on a trip to another country, but it was already June, and everything in Spain and Italy was booked. So we ended up in Bergen.
The only place you could go.
Which obviously there was a hotel free. So we spent 2 weeks near Bergen in Gödesund, a lovely place which doesn't exist anymore. And I fell in love with you guys, with the country, the unspoiled nature, the friendliness of the people. And next year I came back by myself with a friend. I was a biker, I had a little motorbike. And for the next years, every summer I spent in Norway. All my friends went to Greece and Spain, whatever, but I went to Norway and did camping in the wilderness and so on. And my dream was, when I was 20, I wanted to marry a Norwegian girl and move to Oslo.
Oh. And is there anybody out there?
It didn't work out. Luckily, I had a plan B.
Yeah. And you didn't you go to honeymoon?
Yes, yeah. On my honeymoon, we went to Norway. We went to Bergen. and we celebrated my father's 80th birthday here 15 years ago. So Norway has a special place. And when I was told that a Norwegian house made an offer, it really moved me. It was very special that the book came out in Norway and then that it would find so many readers, all my books. That has a very special meaning to me. So I'm the one who has to say thank you to you.
Thank you. In the afterword of the book, you say that you usually play classical music when you write your novels.
Yeah.
But this time you are listening to more electronic music and to my relative, Kygo.
Yes.
Yes.
I don't know why. Yeah, I always listen to music, Chopin, Mozart, Beethoven, and so on. And for this book, my son put a playlist together with Kygo, a lot of Kygo songs. Tropical House is it called, Tropical House music, very different. And I think a little bit you might feel it in the book.
Yeah, is it? Do you feel that? It's,
I think so. The story is a little faster, maybe, and the two main characters are like 18-year-olds, and I got very good responses from younger readers in Germany. Mm. Younger means in their 20s. They sent me emails, and when I did readings, they approached me, said this is the first book they read, and they really like it because it deals with some issues, I think.
Yeah, and
for
then
younger
the two main characters are also. So young, so
yeah.
But let's talk about this novel then. It's in Norwegian. It's called.
Oh, I tried this very hard. You corrected me. Hele verdens terror, terror.
Yeah, it's as good as me. Hele verdens terror. Hele verdens terror.
But yeah, that's what I said.
Yeah, nearly. But what is it called in German?
The rebel. Oh no, die Rebellen und der Dieb.
Yeah, and
it's
in English,
the rebel and the thief.
Yeah, we are more happy with tears than.
I.
But could you tell us, not revealing too much of the suspense, but tell us a little about the story and the main characters?
Ah, that's so hard. You know, I wrote 300 pages and I spent almost a year with the book, and now you want me to sum
we
it up?
300 minutes, so it's okay.
I think. In the end, it's a story part Robin Hood. It's part about two young, a young woman, a young man growing up, realizing that for today's issues, their parents don't have the answers anymore, which is painful to a certain extent. I don't know if you remember the moment where you realized now you're a grown-up because the issues your parents can't deal with anymore for you. I think both of my main characters, Nira and Mary, reached that point where they face problems and the old recipes from their parents, they don't work anymore. And I think we are at that point. I think we all know that the world we are living in terms of the environment, in terms of the social injustice, it's not sustainable. We can't keep going for the next 100 years like this. And I have a son who is 25 years old. We have some very tough discussions at home. He is challenging me and he is questioning me, and rightly so. I think, you know, we messed up to a certain extent. We tried our best. And I think that's one issue in the book, that there's the Niri is 18 years old and he lived in a fictional country, kind of a sheltered life as servants of a rich family. And then a pandemic strikes and the whole family gets kicked out and they end up in a slum and they are starving. He has a 5-year-old sister. She's starving and his father is meditating. And there's not much he can do. He trusts, you know, it's our karma. That's what he said. It must be our karma. And you know, Nuri doesn't want to hear about karma. You know, he has a 5-year-old sister. She can't have bad karma. And his father says, yes, she has, obviously. And so Nuri decides to do something to get food. And he has to steal. He has to break into a house. And in Buddhism, that's not allowed. Same in Christianity, you know, the commandment, I don't know, the 7th or so, don't steal. Same in Buddhism, but what do you do? So I think it's a search for new answers for current problems.
What inspired you? Because this Neri character, when his father says you shouldn't have stolen anything, then what is he doing with the money he had taken?
Now he is, you know, he gives it to his sister and his mom, but then he has more and then he starts to feed other people in the slum. And he realizes how difficult it is sometimes to do good things because a fight breaks out. They're all hungry and there's not enough food for everyone. So he breaks in again and the thing gets bigger and bigger. Where do you stop? And I don't want to reveal too much.
No, but it's kind of a modern Robin Hood story. Is it?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think so.
And do you think that's the solution for our world, that we shall take from the rich and give it to the poor?
Robin Hood is not the solution, of course, because then you will have a civil war.
Yeah.
But my wife asked me the same question. I said, you know, Anna, I'm not a politician. I don't have to give answers. I'm a novelist. I tell stories and I raise questions. And I think we all as societies have to find answers to these questions. That's all I can do.
You said to me that one of your readers said that these are books who give hope, and could you tell that story?
Yeah, this is sometimes, I mean, readers, you are so much smarter than me as an author.
Of course.
No, sometimes it's amazing when you come to me and tell me what my book was about. I said, really? I didn't know. Because the funny thing, this is one book, but if you all read this book, you have read 200 different books, right? Mm. You all read it differently. And the most amazing thing is if you read it in 10 years, you read a new book again because you are a different person then. And I wrote the book, I just wanted to tell the story. And then a woman came up to me and said, you know, for a long time she hasn't read a book that has given her so much hope. And I thought, this is a sad story with, you know, a slum and people starving. And then I realized she is right, because it is about people who have fear, but they overcome their fear. It's about people who do something. And then I realized, you know, in my life I have been to pretty dark places, to really poor slums in Haiti, in India, Sri Lanka. I mean, really places where you think everything is lost. And then I thought about it, and as dark as it was in every single place, I found light. Because wherever you go, there is light. There are people who want to do something, who want to change things, who don't give up, who are selfless, who sacrifice their lives for other people. They exist, they are there in the dark places, and I think that's what I wrote about in the end.
But the main character is fantastic, and also the female, but there are several characters here. And I wonder, how are you writing? Have you all this planned, and you know everything when you start writing a novel?
No, I had Neri and Mary, the kind of Robin Hood constellation, and then I thought, damn, I can't do research for the book, but very soon I realized I had done research for the book for the last 30 years. Mm-hmm. All my trips as a journalist and as a novelist, which led me into slums and into mentions of rich people and, you know, the huts of small poor people, I was like a sponge. I, you know, all sucked it in. And when I wrote the book, it all came back. It was amazing. I was sitting in Potsdam listening to Kygo, and and it all came back. It was like watching a movie. And I wrote this book in a few months. Usually I write a page or two a day. Here I wrote sometimes 5, 6, 7 pages a day.
Because of the music then.
Maybe.
but do you know what will happen all the time?
No.
No? So the characters live their own lives?
It was really the story evolved. There were new characters. Bagura, which is an important character.
Yeah, first was the kind of feeling he's a crook or a godfather in a way in the beginning.
Yeah, he comes across as some mafiosi, but then the whole story changes and he is a man with a big, big heart.
But you hadn't planned that?
No, I just thought Bagura. There must be something like Bagura, and how important he became for the story was just, you know, happened during the writing process.
Yeah, and I wonder, are you thinking of us, your readers, when you write, or is it just for yourself in a way?
I have to disappoint you.
Yeah.
I think of you very often, but not when I write. I basically write the story for myself, for my wife, who is my first reader. She usually reads every chapter. And then if she likes it, I keep writing. If she doesn't like it, we talk about it and I change things. With this book, I actually wanted to write a book set in Japan. But then the virus came and I couldn't travel. And then the story came about. And I decided to use this as kind of an experiment. I write for 4 weeks and maybe it would work, maybe it doesn't. And then I didn't show Anna anything for 4 weeks. And she said, you know, what are you doing? Oh, writing something, I'll show you later. And after 4 weeks, I had 80 pages. And then I showed it to her. And then she loved them. And I sent it to my German publisher. He loved it. And then I just told this story. I don't think of anyone, actually.
But how do you feel that it's very interesting when you're talking about how bad it was in the beginning of your career, but how has your big success affected you as a person and as a writer? That's a big question.
I I think it hasn't affected me that much. It gives me more time now. The advances are bigger, so I have I have more time to think about the story, to do my research, and I'm under no pressure.
Yeah.
That's the most important, which is good, sometimes also bad. some pressure helps, especially, you know, a deadline. No, it's just took some pressure off. Yeah.
Yeah. But now when COVID is nearly over, have you started writing that Japanese book you told us about?
I'm doing the research. I hope to travel, knock on wood, to Japan this time in May. And then I hope to start writing in June or July. And the story is already, the two main characters in my mind, very fixed, Akiko and Kenzo. I already can tell you the name, Akiko Kenzo. And then the working title is The Daughter of the Stone Gardener.
Stone Gardener?
Stone Gardener, yeah. Because the Japanese, they have these stone gardens. And that's the daughter of a stone gardener. Mm. And I have the emotional trouble, the emotional hook. And then I will take it from there.
You told some more at dinner last night, but because it's fascinating, can you tell us about the Japanese kind of way of love life these days?
No, I would
not too much.
That was for your ears.
Okay, it's fantastic, but you'll wait till the book comes then. But Jan Philip, I think that you should just have a last appeal to your public before we thank you. Is there, why do you write, and what do you want them to experience of your novels?
I write because I really love it. It's painful, even though after I have sold many copies, I'm translated into many languages. There's not a single day when I write where I think this sucks. Actually, I really don't know how to do it. And now eventually with this book, the public will finally find out that this guy has no clue what he is doing. He is completely ungifted. He is no storyteller. He has nothing to say. So it's amazing. And my wife, you know, she's an art historian. She says, but hey, what do you need to prove that you know what you're doing? I say, no, this time, eventually the public will find out. So there is no sense of security. The self-doubt is constantly there. Maybe it's some part what keeps me going, I think. So I accepted it. I try to embrace it and not fight it. Say, you know, it's there, I know, but I try my best. And I do it because I really enjoy the process. I have a lot of, you know, fantasy. I've never been bored in my whole life, even as a child. You know, when I was waiting for a bus, whatever, I always had stories. I dreamed about me being a prince, getting the princess, or soccer playing, scoring the goal, or whatever. I always have stories in my mind, and writing them down, I see it as a big privilege. And as I said, you are smarter than me. And some readers say that in all my books, the China trilogy, the Burma trilogy here, it's about dark places, it's about pain, it's about hurt, but it's also about comforting, it's about hope. And I think it's probably that's me, that I can't write a book without not a happy ending, but a book without hope. I have to spend 2 years with it. That would be terrible, with a story where there's no hope.
I would like a last hope for us, because we have discussed Lucinda Riley and Arthur, but she found out that she could write a novel from Norway. Why don't you do that, you?
Hey, you never say...
Never
say never, exactly.
Oh, you should do that. We need
give
some
me
room.
A reason to spend some time here. That would be nice.
We need it. Okay, thank you so much, Jan Philip. Thank you.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thanks for reading my books.
Boktips, en podcast fra Cappelen Damm.
Instrument.